Very thrilled to have on the KSRO live line with us. Christine Pelosi is here. She is a political strategist. She is also head of the California Democratic Party Women's Caucus. And the business card must be very, very large. Christine, good morning.
Good morning, Pat. Thanks for having me.
Very, very happy to have you. And a lot of ground to cover. Let's go back a few days, and you might have heard of Christine's mom. Her name is Nancy Pelosi. And what a performance on the House floor, history-making performance, over 8 hours speaking in favor of DACA recipients. Wow.
It was quite incredible. My dad and I were actually flying out to Washington, D.C. for a House Democratic Caucus Family Issues Conference. So we got on the plane and she was talking. And then I was following it while we were online. And you know, we got Wi-Fi in the sky. And I said, Dad, she's still talking. She's still talking. We landed. She was still talking. We got to the Capitol and she was still talking. It was incredible. The stories that she was telling and the people from all over the country who were tweeting and texting and writing and saying, this reminds, I want to tell my immigrant story now. And that was really the beautiful part of it.
Well, as you know, Christine, we're here in Northern California and, you know, suffered the deadliest wildfires not so very long ago. And so we know a little about the importance of telling our stories and can certainly relate to the folks in favor of DACA and recipients of DACA needing to tell theirs. It's part of evolution for us all.
It really is. And of course, there's so many DACA recipients and documented families and workers in the KSRO listening family community. So we also know that we're talking about people we go to school with, people we go to church with, people that we are, you know, that we work in the vineyards with, all of those, you know, everybody in our community has an immigrant story to tell. And certainly the over 200,000 DACA recipients in California have a big one. But Pat, the important thing is not only that we tell our story, because you're right, Mike Thompson, for example, and Jared Huffman, the members of Congress who represent a lot of areas up north where the fires were, up north from me in San Francisco, but they had to tell the fire story when originally the House of Representatives bill was only going to include tax relief for people who were victims of the storms.
Oh, we were livid about that, believe me. And boy, did we need those staunch supporters to say, wait a minute, that's just wrong.
Right. And look at your local supermarket, look at your local restaurant, and look at the bottles of wine on the shelf. How do you think they got there?
Yeah.
Right? How could you leave people behind? So it was very powerful, you know, leadership of the bipartisan wine caucus, which was really active in the Congress under the leadership of Mike Thompson to really say, no, these are the stories. You have to include everybody. And similarly now at 5:30 today, so 2:30 California, 5:30, the U.S. Senate is going to start voting on an immigration bill. And part of why we need people to keep telling those stories is because we know if they don't, there are elements in the far right of this country who will be telling every immigrant story as if they are
the
rapists and murderers
and immigrant stories
and gang
right.
members and terrible storytelling. So we have to keep telling those positive stories. And it really is about making sure that those stories don't get lost in the relative handful of very negative, awful stories about some immigrants that we don't paint everybody with the same brush. And certainly we don't paint 99% of the people with a bad brush that is absolutely not clear. Just one quick fact for you. The Jeff Sessions Justice Department likes to say that there's been a massive increase in violent crime, and that is due to undocumented immigrants. That is categorically false. The murder rates have actually gone down in this country, and immigrants, on a percentage, commit far less crimes, violent and nonviolent crimes, than American citizens do. So again, we have to be out there truth-telling. We have to be lifting up the stories of the dreamers, their families, and their communities.
In, somewhat the same way, everybody needs to tell their stories and tell what their truth is, sort of the basis of the Me Too movement and how it got started and how it got legs.
Well, that's right. Tarana Burke was an activist, is an activist, but was serving as an activist 10 years ago with teenage black girls who were trying to talk about their experiences having suffered sexual abuse. And so Tarana coined the hashtag #MeToo, and she's written about engagement by empathy and how just a simple #MeToo allows people to feel support and that they are not alone and that there are other people who have struggled with and in many cases found coping mechanisms for surviving abuse. That obviously had a revival back in October when the actress Alyssa Milano used the hashtag to talk about the Harvey Weinstein situation. Yeah. And then when the two were connected, it was very intersectional and powerful. I've been a sexual assault prosecutor in the early days of my legal career and have been an advocate for women and men, but mostly since the victims are mostly female, for over 20 years. And I can tell you it is gratifying to see so many women and men lift the burden of shame and lift the burden of silence in order to tell their stories and place the blame and place the burden where it belongs, which is on the perpetrator.
Well, as a former prosecutor, I need to bring this up because something happened to me over the weekend I never thought would happen. And that is that President Trump said something I agreed with. And, you know, we know about every other comment he's made, whether he's completely ignoring the Me Too movement or he is supporting the people who have since been fired from his administration because of such allegations. The one thing he did say over the weekend is, what about due process? And, you know, even as a feminist and a supporter of these women telling their truths, I have to agree with that. That where does that position itself in the Me Too conversation? The notion that that innocent until proven guilty.
Right at the center, right at the bedrock of our democracy, right where it was, by the way, 20 years ago when Donald Trump accused the Central Park Five, who were exonerated by DNA evidence, when he accused five young black men of raping and assaulting and critically injuring a white female jogger, called for them to have the death penalty. Not a lot of due process.
I
reminded him on Twitter. So it has to be due process for everyone. And by that, I mean the accusers and the accused. And so, again, one of my biggest frustrations is that in this movement, you get a lot of headlines for pursuing Twitter justice, or what I call Twitter justice. I don't know if I've coined the term, but I use it a lot because there's a difference between Twitter justice and lasting justice. And as I told, when we started the Me Too politics letter, Adama Iwu, who's a lobbyist in Sacramento, resident of San Francisco, your listeners might recognize her as an African-American woman on the cover of Time magazine,
right,
as one of the silence breakers. When Adama was actually in a conversation about what do we do about the Harvey Weinstein situation in our own community, and then somebody came in the middle of the conversation, someone came in and hit on her, and when she pried the person off her body and said to the people, "What did I just say about how to be an ally?" They said, "Oh, you were friends. We thought you were okay with it." And she was like, "No, I'm not okay with it." Got mad, wrote a letter, thought maybe a handful of people would co-sign it. We were at 140 people on Monday, the next Monday morning, and broke the letter. And what we said from the start was there is a pervasive culture of sexual harassment in California politics, and we need to make changes. The reporting system is broken, as a male victim found out last week when he went in to confidentially testify against the co-author of the whistleblower bill. And within 48 hours, news media were calling him and asking about the substance of his confidential report.
Right.
We've been asking for the following. Number one, you need to have confidential crisis counseling and reporting systems immediately for people.
Yes.
We said Enough is working on an app that will do that. The technology has been used in schools for about a dozen years against bullying, and we're going to adapt that to the harassment context. We have talked about the fact that you need to have a due process. If you are someone who's being accused, you need to know you're being accused. There need to be something like they have in a civil court where someone's suing you and there's some sort of a stay away order or an admonishment not to contact and intimidate the victim and intimidate the complaining witness, that you do that. They need to have that in politics. And we also need to make sure that we have a transparent system. We still don't know which legislators have ever been accused
of harassment. Yeah, that's such a huge part of this, Christine. Congresswoman Jackie Speier, you know, talked a lot about that beginning in November. And, you know, without transparency, you know, there will be no due process and there will not be this wave, this Me Too wave that turned into a tsunami. It just wouldn't happen without transparency on every side of this.
Well, and that's true. I worked on Capitol Hill as the chief of staff for 4 years, from 2001 to 2005. I actually, at that time, counseled people against going to the House Office of Compliance because it was basically like a black hole. And when I went into representing, we said enough, when I went into a meeting that House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi was holding with Jackie Speier and former EEOC officials, Congresswoman Brenda Lawrence, Congresswoman Ellen Holmes Norton, and there was a plaintiff's attorney there. And I said, I met this plaintiff's attorney, Ms. Katz, 12 years ago when she told me not to, you know, she advised me to advise my client not to go to the Office of Compliance. The fact that 12 years later it's still considered a problem means we have to solve it. But just for our listeners, just so we're clear, We Said Enough has always been about due process. You can, as I said in a lot of these meetings, you can run somebody out of town on a rail. You have not cured the culture. You have not helped the victim, who more likely than not is going to be accused of ruining someone else's career. Mm-hmm. And you haven't solved the problem. So you do need restorative justice. And you do need to say that zero tolerance should not be conflated with one strike, you're out. It should be equated to the conduct of the person. Yeah, the rapists, they've got to go. Some of the huggers and the talkers, they need intense counseling. Maybe they can be returned to the community. That's also up to the voters. Because let's also be clear, when you're asking people to basically fire an elected official in the California legislature under Proposition 50, you are in effect canceling an election, right? And I do think the voters should get the call. There are some cases that are so egregious that the public is going to stand up and say, no, we don't even want you representing us anymore. So politicians have to tread a little bit carefully about how they weaponize these charges, because ultimately it is a court of public opinion and the voters want to have a say, right? That's what happened to Al Franken. 70% of the people in Minnesota think he should have had a verdict. Now, most of them think he probably should have had to not run again, but they wanted him to have a verdict from the ethics committee and not get run out of Washington. Yeah. So we need to be careful. We need to be fair. And we need to remember at the heart of this is the advancement of equity for all. At the heart of this is that there are young men and women who, once they've been sexually harassed, sometimes because people are careless and sloppy and have very bad personal habits, but sometimes also they're harassed or bullied racially in order to eliminate them as a professional threat. And they've been locked out of paths to power. There's a cost economically, politically, emotionally to the people. And if you're going to talk about advancing equity, you really have to look at the consequences of this. And why is it that when people are sexually harassed and they are then politically retaliated against, we don't have accountability? So I want people to be active in advancing in their own communities, in your own political or social clubs. What's your code of conduct? Have this conversation in advance so that you're not having it on the fly after a story has come out.
Yeah, and maybe one day we will actually be able to run for office without fear of what somebody might dig up on us. What about that possibility?
Well, I think that is always, and I've written two books called Campaign Boot Camp, and I do a lot of trainings around the country, training people to run for office. And I say to them what I said in the paper, both the San Jose Mercury News, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the LA Times this past week, the same thing. I would prefer a leader who owns up to past mistakes and shows personal growth than someone who either denies it or tries to pretend that it didn't happen. Personal growth is important. We've all made mistakes. We've all grown up in one toxic culture or another and learned from mistakes. Everyone's human. I think the American people are very forgiving, but you've got to tell your personal story and how, and your own awakening to your bad behavior and what you did to change it and whatever that was, because I think that's what people are looking for. I'm looking for a human being who is going to be open and reflective and humble about mistakes that they've made rather than someone who blames their victims or tries to pretend they don't happen. And that would be my ultimate response to President Trump, right? Due process has to, you know, has to include everybody. And it can't be something that's selective, because the bedrock of our country is due process for all.
Absolutely right. And Chris, we're on the phone with Christine Pelosi. And one more note for you, Christine. I know I was born in San Francisco, and you're a Bay Area gal. And tomorrow, a very big day for us, because it is the official start of spring training. And that means that the San Francisco Giants go back to work. We see what the team looks like for 2018. And all of a sudden, spring has sprung and all things are possible once more.
Thank God. It's an even year. My daughter and I were at Fan Fest this past weekend.
Oh, great.
I'm actually on the board of the juniorgiants.org. If you want to go visit that and check out our junior giants, we have some junior giants Little League baseball leagues in the KSRO listening community.
Fantastic.
Area. So people might want to sign up for that. We're going down to spring training to sell mystery baseballs to support the kids. And it is a wonderful, wonderful thing. We got to see the new players, Longoria and McCutcheon. And we're very excited about the possibility. That's the great thing about spring. It's a new beginning, and at least mathematically, until opening day, we're all in first place.
Listen, I'm a big believer in that, and perhaps one of these days we'll have a conversation that is solely about the Giants. That'll be fun.
Perfect.
Okay. All right, Christine, thanks so much for being here. Look forward to our next conversation.